compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Come on, man.
No, really, seriously. Welcome back. 888-914-9149, sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters, 888-914-9149. We'll go to Melissa straight off the bat. Melissa in Dayton, welcome.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thanks for asking.
Sure. My question is about the mental health institution, psychology, okay, psychiatry, and that sort of thing. So, I struggle with anxiety, which can get pretty severe enough that it can actually make me sick. I pray about this daily, but I also take medication and I see a psychologist. I also have a daughter on the autism spectrum. She sees a psychiatrist regularly, has gone to a psychologist in the past, and we pray about her regularly. So we do seek out, prayer and that sort of thing to deal with these mental health issues. But I was reading in the St. Joseph Sunday Missal this past Sunday, and it says, psychiatrists and mental institutions are reminders of the dangerous threat to our personal safety. Once a person has been referred to them, harm to that person's safety has already been done. And I've heard about this before, to where, seeking out this kind of health or, help can be dangerous. So that kind of hit me hard this weekend when I read that, and I just wanted to kind of get some feedback on that.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. I will begin by saying, not being in that field, I don't have any training or any credentials, so I can't speak with any authority, but I'll offer you my perception of this for what it's worth. And that would be that just as a physician can look after your physical health and often requires very specific knowledge and procedures and things like that to be able to help, sometimes bodily ailments can be difficult to even diagnose. So it requires an expertise that not all doctors have. But we turn to them to find out, what is it that's bothering me and how can I heal that? How can I fix that? Can I fix that? And I would say the same is true in this area, because the soul, of course, can have maladies, can have illnesses, diseases even, not in a physical sense, but things that make the life of prayer and just, your own intellectual and psychological well-being suffer. So there's nothing inherently wrong with seeking to remedy those problems. Let's say somebody with OCD, for example, obsessive compulsive disorder. That's a real disorder. It's a real mental or psychological or psychiatric. I don't know what term the professionals might use, but whichever is the right term. I mean, it's a real phenomenon that people suffer with, and there are ways to help that, to help at least live with it, or if not, overcome it entirely. My thinking in answer to your question would be that it's entirely legitimate to seek assistance with psychological disorders or problems, whatever they may be. But the key is to find somebody who's competent, truly competent, but also trustworthy. So I wouldn't go to Sigmund Freud, for example, because he sexualizes everything. And what's the problem? Oh, well, this must have some sexual root in your life or something like that. I don't buy into that at all. And, I had two semesters, maybe three semesters of psychology when I was in college a long time ago. And I remember thinking, a lot of this seems to be guesswork. I mean, sure, they do studies and they have, scientific approaches to things like that. But even still, what I remember from all those years ago studying psychology was, it struck me as, it's not the kind of science the way math and biology and physics is, where you can test things in a way that lead to certain conclusions. It's more amorphous than that, was my impression. So not being a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a counselor or any of those things, I would say they are helpful and good when you find the right person who's not only competent, but also trustworthy. So often, Melissa, when somebody calls in with a question about this, I try to refer them to their local diocese, because usually the diocese in their family and life department will have referrals to trustworthy counselors or trustworthy psychiatrists or psychologists. And that's because there are some out there, but it's hard to know exactly who they are without a little bit of advice. So I don't think that you're doing anything wrong by seeking relief from these issues, or for your daughter for that matter. But that would be my advice, would be to do your due diligence so that you can really be confident that the therapist or the counselor or whatever is not going to lead you or your daughter in a different and wrong direction with some kind of aberrant treatment that can... I'll give you an example. I became aware of a certain kind of treatment at the psychiatric level, so psychiatrists who have... How can I describe it? One of the problems with this methodology, it seems, is that sometimes, and maybe even often, it results in the planting of false memories in the minds of people who didn't actually experience X, Y, or Z. But a certain kind of psychiatric therapy often results in people having these now false memories implanted in their minds. And they really believe that they happened, but they objectively didn't happen. That's super dangerous, super, super dangerous.
Oh, yeah. So, I've had a psychologist once try to do that. Told me I had been abused as a child and like kept forcing the issue. I was like, really, I wasn't abused. Like, I had a good childhood, you know, and I left him immediately after the first visit. So
smart. Yeah. Well, there's an example of what I'm referring to. And I only know this anecdotally. But so in other words, if you're asking, would I encourage you to continue? I would. But being really, you know, really discriminating in a good sense, trying to find just the right person. You know, St. Thomas Aquinas refers to all this in the Summa 800 years ago, or maybe 700 years ago, but he referred to these things as passions, and not passion like sexual passion. He's referring to these forces that move on us and move against us, emotions, appetites, even psychiatric disorders. That term wasn't around then, but things like scrupulosity or obsessive compulsive disorder, or things that were only given names much later, but he knew what they were and he talked about them. So there's an example of somebody who was very wise, I think, in approaching this topic.
Okay. I think the theme of it in the missal was about, like, I think becoming like too self-reliant, you know, on solving your problems, and how therapy can, you know, lead to that, where I have to fix this instead of looking to God to fix it. Right. So along that line too, I think if you keep that in mind as you're going through it and be aware of that, I guess.
Yes. And part of it too, I think anyway, again, just my own personal opinion without any credentials backing it up, but my impression is that your personality type has a lot to do with this. So the church traditionally, you know, maybe you're familiar with them, the phlegmatic, the choleric, the sanguine, and the melancholic. Oh, you're not? Okay. I would encourage you to look at that. There's a good book by Father Jordan Ammon. I would write this down. I think you'll find this helpful.
Okay.
Father Jordan Ammon, A-U-M-A-N. I think there may be two N's at the end. And it's called Spiritual Theology. And he takes apart, he analyzes for you the four basic personality types. So you have sanguine, melancholic, phlegmatic, and choleric. And each of these personality types has certain strengths and certain weaknesses. And most people, it seems to me, are predominantly one and have some of one or two others. So you might be predominantly sanguine and still have a little bit of melancholic in you or something like that. I think if you were to explore the church's perennial teaching on, they used to be called humors, not like in a funny sense, but like the so-called humors in your body. But St. Thomas does a lot of really good work in this area. And that book, Spiritual Theology, written by a Dominican friar, he, in essence, sort of crystallizes what St. Thomas had to say about these four personality types. And that, too, can help unlock some of these mysteries of the human person.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I'll check that out. Thank you. Okay.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And I think that there may even be a PDF version of that whole book for free online if you look around.
Oh, okay.
I think you can get the book, but if you want to do a freebie,
yeah,
I think you can find it online.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for your input. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I hope things smooth out both for you and your daughter. And
thank you.
You know, hopefully listening to Relevant Radio makes that happen. So thanks for the call.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
All right. Good chatting with you. 888-914-9149. How about Leslie now in Pearl River, New York? Hi, Leslie.
Yeah, good morning, Patrick.
Good morning.
I was just calling because I wanted to ask you, when trying to gain a plenary indulgence, can you offer the plenary indulgence for all the souls in purgatory, or must it be just one soul in purgatory?
Either or both. You can offer your indulgence that you gain for all the souls in purgatory, or you can have one or two specific people. It's up to you, and it can be applied as you wish. And that, by the way, have you ever seen the word suffrage when it comes to like your prayers and suffrages? Suffrage doesn't mean suffering. It means casting your vote for somebody that you might say, dedicating this indulgence to or for. So that's what a suffrage is when you gain an indulgence and you apply it, you ask the Lord rather to apply it to a soul in purgatory or all the souls in purgatory. That's an example of that.
Okay. But if I apply the suffrage to all the souls in purgatory, that wouldn't mean that they all get out of purgatory, does it?
No, but what it does mean is that the Lord, in his mercy and kindness, will apply it as he wishes to the souls in purgatory. So we leave that in his hands. You may not have a particular person in mind, and you say, just Lord, I'm offering this for the suffering souls in purgatory. He applies it in the best possible way, and you don't have to worry because you know that God will always do the very best thing.
Right. So would that mean whoever he offers it, he applies it to, they would immediately be cleansed of all of their sins and go right to heaven?
If he chooses to do that, so when you gain a plenary indulgence and you offer this on behalf of, let's say, a deceased loved one, let's say your grandfather,
mm-hmm.
Well, right. you're entrusting this into God's hands, and he makes the decision how is this applied. Your grandfather may no longer be in purgatory, so he may already be in heaven, and so obviously your prayers are not wasted. God will apply that as he sees fit. So that's where I would say we should always maintain that element of trusting love for God's mercy, knowing that he will do the very best thing. So you make the offering, he applies the offering as he wishes, and everything's great.
Oh, okay, fantastic. And I want to say thank you so much for all that you do for all of us.
You're so kind.
Show has made such a difference in my life.
I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you, Leslie. Thank you for listening. And please tell your friends. Tell everyone in Pearl River, New York about Relevant Radio. We'll get them all listening. Let's go now to Joel in Bozeman, Montana. Hi, Joel.
Hi. I am wondering, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Patrick. And has it been written ever anywhere? I would think canon law, but I haven't seen or rather heard it applied, that people like Obama, Pelosi, Biden, or at least Biden and Pelosi, who call themselves Catholics, haven't been excommunicated from the church. It's not in the code, is it?
Are you asking if excommunication is in the code of canon law? Is that what you mean?
Well, for public officials who claim to be Catholic and they're not.
Well, it is. Yeah, it is. No names are mentioned, but the code of canon law governs the life of the church and your rights and your duties and your privileges and all that. But it also governs things like what happens when a delict is committed, a canonical crime. And so, yes, there is definitely in canon law.
Hasn't it been applied?
Well, I got an answer for you. I've got an answer for you. Okay, so first of all, The section where you're going to be able to start reading this, and there are a number of different scenarios, like what about somebody who throws away a consecrated host or uses a consecrated host for a sacrilegious purpose? There's a section that's Canon 1367. Canon 1364 deals with somebody who's an apostate or a schismatic, that kind of thing. So there are different kinds of crimes or delicts that have the penalty of excommunication. And even excommunication could be something that is automatic, or it could be something that a decree from the church is given. But the point is that the church does talk about in canon law somebody who is an obstinate public sinner who is scandalizing people with this obstinate public sin. Now, when I read those parts of canon law as a non-canon lawyer without canon law training, I mean, I read a lot, but that's not the same thing. I understand that to mean that in a case like you're describing, that it would indeed be the appropriate thing to excommunicate that wayward Catholic who's causing public scandal and is obstinate in his public sin. And that falls to the bishop of that diocese in which the politician lives, or you might say maybe even works in the case of Washington, D.C. So the person who has the competence, the man who has the competence to fulfill this prescription in the church's law is the bishop. And so your question really is one that only the bishop could answer. I can't answer. I can't say, well, why wasn't, you know, X, Y, or Z politician ever excommunicated? It kind of looks to me, looking at canon law, that that's what should have happened. But in the case where it doesn't happen, ultimately, that's going to be the prerogative of the bishop. And it's possible that maybe there was some private conversation. And often we'll hear about that where the bishop says, well, I have consulted directly with this person and told her what to not do anymore. Don't present yourself for communion until you've fixed this issue. Sometimes when that comes out in public, you find that the politician just simply ignores the guidance from the bishop. And that's another scandal, by the way. And then sometimes you will see a bishop. It doesn't happen very often, but it has happened. Cardinal Raymond Burke, when he was the Archbishop of St. Louis before he was made a cardinal, he excommunicated a wayward, I think it was like a Polish church, kind of an ethnic Catholic church in the archdiocese that was going bonkers and disobeying his authority. And so, as I recall, he excommunicated them. So these things do happen, but not very often.
Hey, I've got a very interesting point to add quick. I saw a little short video on YouTube of a Catholic priest in South Carolina who had refused to give Biden Holy Communion. And the correspondent asked him, she said, well, does that bother you that you were refused Holy Communion? And he says, in a very low voice, nah. He said, I got communion from the Pope. Can we excommunicate the Pope?
This is something that popes will have to answer for, bishops will have to answer for, but thankfully you and I, Joel, don't have to answer for this. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
Tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo. Uno, dos, tres.
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday,
coast to coast, on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day. Favorite. That's the reason why I'm more away.
I'm just waiting.
I don't care, homie, let them hate.
Let hate. I'm just trying to eat another plate.
Another one. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no.
That's my favorite part right there. Welcome back, 888-914-9149. I know, Cyrus, why you're doing this, because people get antsy and irked if you don't play that song at some point.
It's the nastiest emails I get are when I don't play that specific song.
Yeah. I can just picture all the homeschooling moms with all their children at the kitchen table. And when that song comes on, I bet you all those kids are dancing around the kitchen. I can just picture it.
They love it. And I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but I got one email. It's like, it was my daughter's birthday and she waited all day for her taco song and you never played it.
Oh, Cyrus, how dare you?
I know, I'm awful.
Wow. Well, see that it doesn't happen again. That's all I can say. People love
right,
it.
That's right.
They love it.
Lesson learned.
888-914-9149. Let's start with Todd in Wanakee, Wisconsin. Hi, Todd.
Hey, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I just wanted to say a thanks to everybody at Relevant Radio. You guys are like, you know how people take one-a-day vitamins? That's kind of what I think of your radio station as when I get up in the morning.
I love that. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. And actually, I have a request this morning. My mother-in-law is going in for to have fluid removed from her lungs, and she's a survivor of cancer for the last 7 years. So if you could remember Bernie in your prayers,
yes,
I would appreciate it.
Will do.
And another thing is her husband is pretty he's had Parkinson's for a long time, so he's pretty frail. And so he's probably getting closer to the end. I'm wondering what, and this might help a lot of listeners, if you have somebody in your family that's Catholic and they do pass away, what would you want to have done to you? I mean, what is the proper prayers that should be said and in the order they should be done and that type of thing?
Okay. The first thing is that the church has certain guidelines for us as Catholics to follow when it comes to things like massive Christian burial, for example. That would be a very important thing to have. So the typical process, Todd, would be that after somebody dies, at some point, not too long after that, there would be what we call the wake, and we Catholics refer to it as the rosary. Non-Catholics might call it a wake, but we pray the rosary as a request for the repose of that person's soul. We have a massive Christian burial, typically the following day. Then there's the rite of burial that takes place in the cemetery, typically. So these are all the rites of the church that are proposed to us to follow. Sometimes it's not possible. Sometimes there's no body. Sometimes the weather doesn't permit graveside, you know, the ritual of interring the body. The church also says that we should remember to pray indefinitely for the repose of the soul of that person. So that can take the form of just in your private devotions, whatever prayers you typically say, you would make a mention of for the repose of the soul of that person. The Gregorian masses are also prescribed by the church. This goes all the way back to the time of St. Gregory the Great, Pope St. Gregory the Great in the 500s. And he promoted the teaching. It's not a teaching at a doctrinal level, but the custom of having masses offered on behalf of the repose of the soul of that person. So that's another example of that. So these are all things that the church suggests that we do. And wherever possible, we should do that. Now, if you're wondering about like private prayers or devotions at the bedside, if somebody has passed away or they're in the hospital, that's entirely up to you. Ideally, if you can have the priest there to administer the sacraments before the person dies, that would most commonly include the sacrament of holy anointing, used to be called extreme unction. And if the person could receive the sacrament of confession, and even better, if the person could receive the Holy Eucharist, the Viaticum, those are all ideal. They're not required, but that's the custom. So if, as the person is approaching death, you were to do that, that would be a very good thing, receiving the apostolic pardon, blessing, etc. So I hope that answers your question, Todd, and I appreciate the call. Thank you. Let's go to John now in Chicago. Good morning, John.
Morning, Patrick. And my question was, I remember you saying some months ago about a Catholic organization that helps couples with fertility. Can you give me a reminder on that?
Yes, it's the John Paul II Institute in, where are they? They're in, what is that sound? Good heavens. The John Paul II Institute in Austin, Texas. And they're, let's see, I want to get you their website, because if you go there, they can refer you to an affiliated group that they work with or is, you know, part of the organization that helps specifically with fertility issues. So the John Paul II Life Center is what it's called. It's JPII, so the Roman numerals for two, JPII, I'll start over, JPIIlifecenter.org, JPIIlifecenter.org. Now, from there, you'll be able to branch off to the affiliated organization that helps with fertility issues. I think it's called the Vitae Clinic. I'd have to double check that. And they use NAPRA technology. They have ways that they can help couples overcome fertility issues. And it would be well worth your time to check in with them. But that's where you would find them. So JP, let's see, I want to make sure I give it to you right. So it's the JPIIlifecenter.org. That's where you'll find them. Let's see, where did John go? There we go. Does that help, John?
Yeah, that helps. Thanks.
Okay, good. I'd also recommend the Gianna Center for Women's Health and Fertility. That's another. Cyrus, do you happen to know what their website is offhand?
Yeah, I was just there. I was just checking out the JP2 Life Center.
And mm-hmm. It's one of their affiliated groups, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. So I was just doing a quick search when I heard his question, and mm-hmm. of course I've lost.
Of course. Of course. Well, if I do the same thing all the time. But you can get to it by going to that main website, the John Paul II Life Center, and you'll be able to get to it that way.
The Gianna Center is CatholicHealthLI.org.
CatholicHealthLI.org?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very good. I didn't know about their website. Well, good. Thank you for that. Appreciate the call. I hope that's helpful to you. Let's go to Elliot in Silicon Valley. Good morning, Elliot.
Good morning. I had a question. I was wondering, about numbers 515 through 521.
Okay.
Perhaps I'm reading it wrong. Perhaps I'm completely missing the point. But it would seem to me like this is an endorsement of abortion, because isn't bringing about a miscarriage the same thing as an abortion?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly related to that. Yes, it would be like a chemical abortion or a non-surgical abortion. I have the answer, I think, to your question. So in Numbers 5, beginning in verse 15, it talks about a husband who's jealous of his wife because he's concerned or worried, or he thinks that she has been unfaithful. And so there's a ritual that is prescribed here where he brings his wife to the priest, he sweeps up some of the dust from the floor, he puts the dust into a container with water, and the woman has to drink this water. And if the curse, in other words, it was kind of like the thought that comes to my mind, like the trial by fire, where if you're guilty, you're made to walk through fire. And if you are innocent, the fire will not harm you. If you're guilty, then you get burned. Now, that's obviously not an objectively factual way to determine if somebody's guilty or innocent, because that fire is going to burn you outside of a miracle. So in this case, this ritual is, that's all it is. And there is actually no ingredient. It's just the dust on the floor. There is no ingredient that is going to harm either the woman or the unborn child. It's a symbolic ritual. And it says in verse 21 that if she is guilty of infidelity, that this will make her body swell and the curse will pass into her bowels and her thigh will fall away and the woman shall say amen. Well, none of this actually would happen unless there was some miraculous intervention. And we don't have any record of that. So this water of bitterness and the woman drinking the water and the curse that allegedly would come upon her is purely symbolic because it doesn't actually cause any of those effects. So it would be a ritual, and I would say similar in a way to the red heifer or the scapegoat, for example, in the Mosaic Covenant, where the scapegoat was the symbol of the animal upon whom all the sins of the people were ritually put onto that animal, and then it was driven out into the wilderness. That's where we get the term scapegoat. But it didn't really happen, and the people's sins weren't really put on that animal, and that animal didn't really do anything wrong. It's all symbolic. It's like theater. And it was a way to symbolize the sins of the people, etc. So my understanding of Numbers chapter 5 is that this is a kind of symbolic ritual that falls into the same kind of category. You know, that the woman is saying that she's innocent, and this little ordeal that she goes through, which doesn't amount to very much, is a way of showing that you have to be truthful, because if you're not truthful, then God may punish you, and so on and so forth. So I'll leave it at that, but that's my off-the-cuff take on this passage.
Well, that's very useful. It's a different spin on my interpretation, but I'll have mm-hmm. to research it in more depth later on.
Yeah.
And maybe we can have another discussion in the future when I know a little bit more about this.
I would like that, Elliot. I always enjoy when you call.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Good chatting with you, too. I appreciate that call. Let's see if we can get to Bunny in Fenton, Missouri before the break. Good morning, Bunny.
Good morning, Patrick. My question to you is, I have a lifelong friend that, you know, we've just kept in touch through the years, but, you know, drifted apart also. And make a long story short, she has cancer, and unless this bone marrow transplant that she's going to receive saves her, she's knows she's on her deathbed. Okay?
Okay.
And so I texted her the other day, and I asked her, I said, now, are somebody bringing you the Eucharist? Have you been able to go to Mass? You know, mm-hmm. questions along those lines. I was stunned when she wrote back and said that actually she stopped going to Mass when the priest abuse occurred. And she said, and she started doing a little research into that and learned that it has happened through the years, through the centuries. And so she stopped going to Mass. I know from when we were young, her and both her husband were very devout Catholics. And I'm wondering if you could give me any kind of guidance as to what I could do to possibly bring her back or help her.
I have a couple thoughts on that issue. The first one is what a non sequitur it is for somebody to say, I left the Catholic Church because members of the Catholic Church in leadership, so bishops, cardinals, priests, whatever, they were not living up to the moral standards that Jesus gave his church. It's a non sequitur. It doesn't make any sense. If you believe that those standards are what we should strive for, then if the fact that somebody doesn't live up to those standards, why would you then stop striving for that? Why would you depart from the church? It doesn't make any sense. It's a very incoherent reason or excuse, really. It's not really a reason. I would say it's more of an excuse to say, well, I'm out of here because that guy did something heinous. I'm out of here. What? It doesn't make any sense. So I don't know to what extent you can reason with her on that issue, but I would propose that you do what you're trying to do and help her. It could be something as simple as if you're able to visit her. I suppose you could do this over the phone as well, but if you could visit her and bring with you the Divine Mercy Chaplet, the little trifold brochure, and pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet with her. One of the promises, as you may know, that God gave to St. Faustina was that there would be profound miracles of conversion often at on the deathbed. And it could be that that will crash through whatever barrier she's put up here and allow her to say, yes, I would like a priest to come and visit me and hear my confession and all of that. But I think in any case that you are in a good position to try to help her as best you can.
Okay.
You don't sound too pleased, or maybe you're not convinced. What do you think?
Well, I've been praying the chaplet for her, and I've been telling her that, and she knows that, and she thanks me, and I don't, and she says she prays. She just doesn't go to Mass anymore, and I agree with you. It is a total excuse, but I just didn't know how to rationalize with that with her.
Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, I found this much to my frustration in my own life, that sometimes the thing that you can see so clearly, it's so obvious and clear, and yet somebody else just won't see it or they can't see it. And I often am, I'm amazed at times that something that's so obvious can't be seen by the other person. So this is one of those mysteries of human free will interacting with God's grace. So my humble suggestion would be just continue being a good friend, trying to help her in your own loving way. Be persistent without being pushy. I'm sure you're not pushy at all, but just be there for her and we'll see what happens. And I mean, God respects our free will, and God forbid that she refuses his grace, but miracles happen.
I have a little question tied to that. Since she obviously probably a mortal sin, I don't know that for a fact, but if she hasn't been going to Mass and she's been able to, I would think for years. But is it still efficacious for me to have a Mass set for her now? Will she receive the benefits of that?
She would receive the spiritual benefit in the sense that God's grace can move her. It won't be sanctifying grace, which you receive from the sacraments that's in your soul. But you can obtain actual graces for her that are external, that can nudge her and move her in the direction of repentance. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Pray the rosary, pray the chaplet.
Forget the two different kind of graces. Okay.
Right.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You are welcome. And God bless you in your effort to try to help this lady. I will pray that you are abundantly successful. And I'll be right back. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
All right. Taco Tuesday, man. This is great. I kind of remember this song.
It's the song that won't go away.
Yeah, it's a good song, though.
It is a good song.
Let's see. 888-914-914. Teresa now in Plantation, Florida. Hello, Teresa.
Hello. Buenos días. ¿Cómo estás, Patricio?
Buenos días. Estoy bien, gracias.
Patricio.
How may I be of service? I said, how may I be of service? ¿En cómo puedo servirle? You know what? We'll have to talk in English because most people listening don't speak Spanish.
Yes, I know. Okay. I'm trying to be nice. Yeah.
You're so nice.
My sister, I can't speak English. I speak with difficulty because I have beginning of Parkinson's, so I'm having a little trouble with my tongue, you know.
Your English is excellent. Please proceed.
Thank you, Patricio. Yeah. Thank you. My sister-in-law passed away in February. She was a evangelical.
Okay.
She has two daughters, and her body was cremated, and they gave it, they gave the ashes to one of the oldest ones.
Okay.
To the oldest daughter. Are you listening to me clearly?
Yes, I hear you loud and clear.
Okay. One of the daughters that is not, one of the daughters that received the ashes went to her evangelical church together with her. She misses her, and I understand that. The other one, who is away from the church, from any religion, who is agnostic, I guess I would call it agnostic, she said to me yesterday, "Tia, I am really, excuse me, I am going to get a little bit of the ashes. Oh, by the way, her ashes are sent to another country where she's from. Mm-hmm. But one portion of the ashes is going to stay with one of the other daughter who wants to go to the beach and throw it in the..." Just, I couldn't believe it, but I was listening to Patricio. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because she was telling me that she's going to the beach and she's going to try to throw away some of the ashes in the... I said, for some dignity, your mother deserves to be considered with dignity and remember with dignity. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'm going to find out what to do. I know that it's a, if that's not, it's not not allowed in the Catholic Church. And I know you're not Catholic, but I understand that. I said, Tia, would you please get me the scriptures in the Bible where I can refer to the ashes, not throwing them away in the ocean.
I understand. Yeah, I can see this would weigh on you, Teresa. So let me, first of all, say there are no verses, none that I'm aware of anyway, but I believe there are no verses in the Bible that say that you can't scatter ashes. I don't think it's even discussed in Scripture. The custom among the Israelites of old and then the Jews later on was to bury the bodies. So they had cemeteries. They did not cremate bodies. So that was the custom of the time, but I don't believe that there is any prohibition directly about scattering ashes. So one thing to remember is that, yes, the church does say that for Catholics that the body, if the body is cremated, then the ashes should be gathered and placed in an appropriate place like a columbarium or a mausoleum. Now, also, just in the last few months, the Vatican also sort of adjusted or gave, as this article from the Catholic Bishops Conference says, just a few months ago, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith said that the ashes of the person who dies must be preserved in a consecrated place. But it also said, this is a little bit of a concession, that although contrary to and completely a departure from what the church said before, it added a little bit of wiggle room here, saying that a family member could keep a part of the ashes in a sacred place of significance. That's the wording that they used. So that is a change just recently in the church's, prior to this time, prohibition of like scattering ashes. The prohibition to scattering ashes still is there, still in place. But to keep a small part of the ashes in your home, I guess, there is a loophole now opened up for that. So that's something that people can read about. We'll post a link to this article. It's actually on the U.S. Bishop's website, but you might find it difficult to find. So we'll get a link to that for you. But the thing to remember is if these people are not Catholic, this rule does not apply to them. So the church does not say that nobody on planet Earth is allowed to scatter ashes. It just says that Catholics, under the traditional circumstances accepting this recent modification, that the ashes have to be completely gathered as best they can be, not scattered, and they have to be put into a sacred place like a columbarium or mausoleum. That's what the church has always said. It modified it slightly. But this doesn't apply in any case to non-Catholics. So do you see what I'm saying?
I know,
if the people you're talking about are not Catholic, this doesn't even apply to them.
Yes, I know, but she's listening to me, and I want to take the opportunity to tell her.
Yeah. No, I get it. Well, here's what I would say. If she's not a Catholic, this doesn't apply to her. You could encourage her to do what Catholics do. And if she at any time in her past used to be a Catholic and then fell away, of course, to me, the big picture issue would be to help her come back to the church before it's too late. But if she's not a Catholic, this rule doesn't apply to her. But it's good of you, Teresa, that you would want to seek after doing the right thing for her. And I do appreciate your phone call. Thank you. Let's go now to Patrick in Trenton, New Jersey. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Pat. Okay, so I told you about my son before. He met a Muslim girl in high school. Now he graduated, and he decided to become Muslim himself. I don't think he's really far gone. I think he's just lacking some confidence in himself. Could you help me with a book that I can suggest to him? His birthday's coming up this week. I was going to try to get him some on Amazon. He's going to be 19.
Okay. Yeah, I would recommend you go to jihadwatch.org and get books by Robert Spencer. He's written, I don't know, a couple dozen books on the topic. He is a... he's Catholic, and he is coming at this from a critical perspective. And as you might imagine, many Muslims just hate his guts because he writes critically about the religion, etc. But he's very fact-based. He quotes all the sources, and he's very effective. So if I didn't recommend that to you, Patrick, before when you called me last time, that's what I would recommend. So his name is Robert Spencer. The website that he maintains is called jihadwatch.org. Check it out. And I hope that that helps your son, because we don't want him to apostatize and leave Jesus, which is what would happen if he became a Muslim. So let's pray, Patrick, that your son doesn't take that fateful step. Thank you. Let's go to Ruth now in Raleigh. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
Oh, I am well, thanks.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Good.
Everybody does.
It's just automatic. So yeah. My question, I need your input. My niece is being, quote-unquote, married to her girlfriend this fall, which, of course, I'm not going to that wedding or anything surrounding that. And I have no problem explaining why I am not going. And the question that sometimes comes up is, well, God made all people, so why do you have a problem with that and with gay people? And then I talk about, I don't have a problem. I love my niece dearly. I love people. Sorry about that. And I'm able to explain that marriage is between a man and a woman. And that's pretty good. But I just need your thoughts. This obviously is a problem in the family.
Oh, my gosh, yes, it is. And there are countless families who are dealing with this difficulty that you're describing here. So I bet you a lot of people listening are saying, yep, I'm in that same situation. So I'll give you a few preliminaries, Ruth, and then it might and probably will carry us through the break into the next segment, if you don't mind holding. If it comes to it, then we could do that. But let's put it this way. We could begin by saying that when God creates the human soul, he creates things good. God does not create evil, and certainly when it comes to human beings, he doesn't create us in a way that is not in keeping with his nature as a good and loving God. So the first thing that we can posit in our discussion about this would be that, yes, God creates us prepared to live in this world with all of its vagaries and difficulties and trials and challenges and all those things. And he creates us in such a way that we can, as Jesus says, that we can know the truth, and the truth will set us free. So one of the fundamental realities of every single person who is born is that in terms of the soul, not always the body, due to things like blindness or mental retardation or other problems that the person can't help, but it's a bodily issue. But the soul itself is, you might say, like a tabula rasa, the Latin for a blank slate. And upon that blank slate, life's experiences and decisions will be written. But we all come into existence with that tabula rasa. We're blank slates, you might say. And this means that we are created by God to know the truth. And in the case of people who are not inhibited by problems, like, say, blindness as one example, or some other debilitation, or mental retardation, or something like that, we have the ability to know the truth. Ah, see, I knew that would happen. So how about this, Ruth? Do you mind holding, and we'll come back to this question about, did God make homosexuals that way? Is that how they are? Did God do that? And if so, if God did that, does that mean that they're off the hook, so to speak? I'll offer some more thoughts on that on the other side of this quick timeout. So please, everybody, don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.